KPCW News time is 8:06. Well, it was remarkably warm yesterday, which made for some slightly slushy skiing. Let's check in with Cedric Haynes of the ABC Weather Center to find out whether spring is here to stay. What are we looking at, Cedric?
Good morning. Yeah, well, it is not necessarily going to remain spring-like out there across the area. Although we've enjoyed some nice, very warm temperatures the past couple of days, things are coming to an end. In fact, they've already changed a little bit out there as we had a cold front make its way through last night. Brought a few showers, but for the most part, nothing too significant. Now we're waking up to a lot of cloud cover, and the clouds will stick around with us through much of the day today. And this afternoon, with some daytime heating, we could see some isolated showers begin to develop out there across parts of the area. So do be aware that don't expect a ton of rainfall out there, but there could be a few scattered rain showers developing this afternoon. High temperatures in Park City should climb to near 50 degrees today, but of course that's much cooler than where we have been the past couple of days. And in the Heber Valley, we should see those highs climbing to around the upper 50s this afternoon. Again, most of us will just be spent with mostly cloudy skies, but a few pop-up showers are possible, especially after about 2 o'clock this afternoon into the evening hours. Now, as we go into tonight, we'll see those clouds really thickening up, and the main part of our storm system arrives as we go into our Saturday, and that will start to bring us some changes there. We're looking at the chance of off and on rain and snow showers throughout the daylight hours on your Saturday across the Heber Valley. Mostly probably going to be in the form of some rain showers, but could have some snow showers mixed in. Temperatures climbing to around 50 to 51 degrees for a high in the Heber Valley. In Park City, we're looking at a mixture of rain and snow showers, but could be more snow than rain showers throughout the day as we see those highs only climbing into the low to mid 40s there in Park City. Now, tomorrow night, we'll see any of that rain switching over to snow in both Park City and the Heber Valley before ending as we see those overnight lows dropping down into the 20s by early Sunday morning. All said and done with this first system that moves on through by Sunday morning, we could be looking at places, let's say, around the Heber Valley picking up anywhere from a trace up to 2 inches of snow. And then for Park City, we could pick up an inch or two of snow as well with the system that moves through. Not a big system, but one that could cause some discussion, especially after those temperatures were very warm. The key and the bigger story is probably going to be a stronger storm that will arrive as we head towards the beginning of next week that has a much better chance of bringing overall snow back to the area from Park City and in the Heber Valley, and it could be a significant snow event. So we're definitely not going to be done with winter. As we go into the weekend, we're looking at highs again in the 40s in Park City. We'll be looking at highs in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. But as we head into next week, we're talking highs only in the 30s in Park City with that good chance of snow moving in, especially Monday night into Tuesday. And we'll see that chance of snow even in the Heber Valley Monday into Tuesday. Highs on Monday in the low 40s, lows by Tuesday morning down into the mid 20s. So accumulations look likely then. But for now, let's just enjoy that slushy skiing, as you like to call it.
All right, Cedric, thanks. Thanks and have
Thank
a good
you.
Weekend.
No problem. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Well, let's see what this warm weather has done to the avalanche risks in the backcountry. On the phone, I've got Greg from the Avalanche Center.
Yeah, good morning. And yeah, you just heard the weather forecast. You know, it was warm and windy yesterday, but slight cooling, and that has definitely helped. You know, we haven't had below freezing temperatures for several days, but many mountain locations today are below freezing. I'm expecting the avalanche danger is going to be rising to moderate today, and I have a lot of uncertainty today about what will happen. If the temperatures stay cool, if we have cloud cover, if we have wind, the snow surface may stay frozen and it won't soften up. But if the temperatures warm up a little bit, the sun works its way through, the winds don't blow quite as hard as I'm expecting, the snow surface will soften and we'll have a moderate avalanche danger. So it really depends upon the conditions. They're very conditional dependent. Yeah, and going forward, you know, we're expecting some snow this weekend, or, you know, beginning tomorrow, and next week looks active. So moderate danger today, and you know, we're probably going to be back to winter-like temperatures, winter-like conditions this weekend, and not a moment too soon. It's been quite a rapid warm-up of the snowpack this past week. So moderate today, and always, you know, visit the UtahAvalancheCenter.org for the latest details.
All right, Greg, thanks very much. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with newly named Park City School Principals Caleb Fine and Isaiah Falou. Then Park City Council Member Ed Parisian will stop by with a debrief from last night's Park City Council meeting. We'll hear from Sydney Weaver, Mitch Elliott, and Connor Thomas of KPCW about their unusual ski day last week. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with Jennifer Wesselhoff of the Park City Chamber of Commerce about the implications of the Sundance departure. Right after the show, we're gonna roll into the weekend with a community campfire. We'll be there lacing up for a wild ride with a story on roller skating fitness that'll have you gliding on good vibes. Then it's time for Coach Skinner's Skinny on Sports, plus heartwarming and hilarious tales from our very own Campfire Kids. It's fun, fresh, and full of local flavor. Stay tuned for the local news hour coming up right after this program. The Park City Planning Commission moved to deny a proposal Wednesday to redevelop the DoubleTree Hotel on Park Avenue, also known as The Arrow. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Last October, a majority of commissioners didn't support a 10-foot height exception for the project at the intersection of Park Avenue and Kearns Boulevard. However, there was no official vote at the October meeting. At that time, the project was continued to a date uncertain. The 5-1 vote on Wednesday ratified the commission's denial of the project. The owner of the property, Singerman Real Estate, didn't make any major changes to the project since the October meeting. Singerman wants to demolish the decades-old hotel to make way for a modern mixed-use development. Buildings would be up to 45 feet tall and include a condo hotel, affordable housing, commercial space, and offices. The proposal exceeds the 35-foot height limit established by city zoning. A lawyer for the property owner argued the project would deliver numerous benefits, including affordable housing, pedestrian improvements, and underground parking. Rick Shand was the sole commissioner to vote in favor of the proposal. He said the project would improve the area compared to the existing hotel, which was built in 1977. Commissioner Bill Johnson said he was okay with the height exception, but he had numerous questions about other aspects of the project. Several residents, including Mountainlands Community Housing Executive Director Jason Glidden, spoke in favor of the redevelopment. The Planning Commission's vote can be appealed within 10 days. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Yesterday, Governor Cox signed H. Bill 356, which was sponsored by South Jordan Republican Representative Gordon Teicher. It was the third-to-last bill pushed through the 2005 General Assembly, General Session's midnight close on Friday, March the 7th. The bill, now law, will require Summit County to elect its council members from 5 voting districts. Currently, all those seats are at large. The full story on the bill can be found on our website, Connor Thomas's story from March 11th. In January of 2004, Park City High School senior Caleb Fine scored 28 points in a basketball game Park City High School lost to Judge. The team was 2-28 at the time. In the fall of 2010, Isaiah Falou was a Park City High School junior in a class taught by a young teacher named Caleb Fine. The seeds planted in those formative years really took root. Fine was recently named principal of Park City High School, and Falou was named principal of Ecker Hill. They both join us this morning. Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger. We only lost 18 games, not 28. I got it.
Thank you, Roger, for the invitation. It's good to be here. Good morning.
All right. You both have had career paths that have taken you back to Park City. Caleb, can you share a bit about why you decided to teach in the Park City schools, and then what drew you to administration?
Yeah, Roger, I mean, teaching at Park City Schools has been the joy of my life, professionally, certainly. And ultimately, it was a complete change of plan. When I sat in the seats of Park City High School, I never thought I'd be back as a teacher, educator.
And principal.
Crazy things happen. I had an opportunity to spend some time at an AIDS orphanage in Africa and really fell in love with working with kids. And when I came back, Hillary Hayes and Doug Payne were looking for a boys basketball coach. I played basketball in college despite our 2-18 record. And at that time, it was like, I'd love to teach too. Had an opportunity to start teaching business. That's how I got to teach your daughter and Isaiah and a lot of other amazing students and really fell in love with education since.
Okay, and Isaiah, your path took you away from Park City for a while.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about how that worked out. What did you do after school, and how did you end up back here?
Yeah, I think my story back to Park City is actually very cliche. Like, I went through schools K-12. I'm a very proud testament to the great work that we do here. And so, like, on the backs of great schools, on the backs of great teachers, I was like, you know, I love school. I want to do this every day. I want to go to school every day. And so actually left to go to college up in Idaho and was an elementary ed major and then got my first teaching job out in Idaho as well, on the western side of the state, teaching fifth grade in Caldwell, and was a good teacher out there, and got affiliated with an organization, Teach for America. Learned a lot about instructional coaching and like grouping teachers together and great curriculum development. And then wanted to move back closer to home. I like from Utah. I love the space. I was like, I want to be back home again. I want to go back to school. So I ended up teaching actually second grade. So moved down in grade levels, taught second grade in the Canyons District for a while, and loved that. And then had been a good teacher. Had been a solid instructional coach. Was like, you know what, I kind of want to expand my sphere of influence. I am interested in leadership, am interested in administration. Went back to school and was kind of looking for my big break, and Caleb Fine had a job posted. I was like, hey, this is the community I know, these are people I know, and I'm going to throw my hat in the ring, and very fortunate to be back, and very excited.
And both of you have expressed, it's evident that you have a love of classroom teaching.
Yes.
And yet, both of you have taken a path into administration. Let me ask you first, like what drew you to administration, Caleb, and do you miss the classroom?
I think that you do miss the classroom every day. One of my favorite things to do is to get to guest teach in financial literacy, my favorite class. So you miss it, but you scratch that itch where you can. Ultimately, the reason that I was drawn to administration was my business background and getting to operate Fine Lawn and Landscape here for quite a long time prior to Mark Kimball taking it over was the combination of leadership and education, and where can you find that? In education, that's in administration. So the pull was to kind of balance both worlds. And I've loved every second of being an administrator.
And Isaiah, same question. What drew you to administration?
Yeah, I do miss being a classroom teacher. I love that for several hundred students, I will always be Mr. Falau. That was their fifth grade teacher, their second grade teacher. But what I think drew me to administration is just this idea of like expanding spheres of influence. Like I want to help children, and you can do that most intimately in a classroom setting. But and I did that, and I thought I did that well, and I did that as a team lead and as a coach. But I want to again expand that sphere, and so that brings me to administration and thinking about ways we can look at systems and school structures and the different things that are intertwined and weave with them to help even more children a little bit more broadly.
How do you think the experience that middle and high school students are going through now, how is that different than when, let's start with you, Caleb, you went through high school 20 years ago. It's hard to rub it in. How do you think the experience of students today is different?
Well, when I went to high school, text messages was just becoming a thing. I think I got away with it a little bit as a student because teachers might have thought I was meditating when I was looking down. And now we know that I think the biggest difference is the impact of technology. And technology is not necessarily good or bad. It's a thing. It's how we utilize it. But we know that our students are constantly being absorbing information via technology and countering that with positive educational experiences and making sure that we are providing opportunities to become critical thinkers, managing the distraction of technology and leveraging it as a tool for learning is likely the biggest challenge that I think kids face in today's new educational environment.
I want to stay with that critical thinking point because that is really an issue. You know, the fact that when you were in high school, you probably didn't have all of the world's knowledge in a phone that's sitting in your hand, and now there's access to all sort of raw data. And there's access to AI, to GPT chat, to other ways that, for lack of a better term, allow you to sort of cheat in the sense of getting an answer. How do you get students to really do their own critical thinking? What kind of tools are you hoping your teachers implement? But I'd like to hear that. Isaiah, what's your answer to that one?
Yeah, what comes to top of mind is that I had the opportunity to attend a very well-done conference yesterday about personalized competency-based learning. That is the mode and the structure that the state is moving in. That's what we're developing our structures and systems in Park City around. But there was a professor there, Dr. David Boren, down at BYU, and he said that he talked about these different elements, that we have been so knowledge-focused, mm-hmm. and we need to consider switching our teaching and our like just the way we deliver curriculum and otherwise to center around skills and dispositions so that students can utilize the skills and dispositions to push critical thinking, knowing that they can access the knowledge with the technology and all the other information and otherwise that's out there. So I think our charge is to switch and to center on building skills and appropriate dispositions.
And that probably is going to get reflected in an evolving curriculum, right? Because, I mean, how do you sort of, particularly when you're looking at these students who are going to graduate into a world where we may well see AI taking care of all kinds of what were previously intellectual tasks, right? How do you prepare students for that world where they're going to have to compete with those kinds of skills?
So we got to expose them to as many problem-solving opportunities as we can, right? What AI can't replace is creativity of the human mind. It can't replace the problem-solving and the intuition and the ability to overcome adversity and the relational aspect. You know, we are relational beings, I believe that, and we want to put our students in situations to develop great relationships, to be a positive impact on this world through great critical thinking and problem-solving. So we're pushing personalized competency-based learning, so we're hoping that every teacher challenges our students to be a critical thinker and not just an encyclopedia of information. You don't need to be the producer of the information. You need to be the critical thinker.
And sort of another aspect of preparing students is looking at vocational education, which I think the new expansion at Park City High School will provide some new opportunities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the expansion of Park City High School, whether it be in a traditional class and the collaboration opportunities that are going to be our students are going to be exposed to because of these open and dynamic spaces, or in our CTE wing that is opened up, that's just truly remarkable. We want to give kids hands-on exposure. We want to give them the skills to do things, whether it's in culinary or construction. And what we like is, even if they don't go into that career path, they're still getting exposed to problem solving and teamwork to build a solution. So we believe that these opportunities are incredible. We're grateful for the community that they got behind the general obligation bond, because these spaces are remarkable. It's where I certainly want my children to learn.
And again, just for those who aren't familiar, there is a new sort of building that's on sort of between the existing high school building and Dozier Field. And there's going to be culinary. What else is in that building?
So we have construction, health sciences, culinary, computer sciences, aviation, drones, engineering. When you go there, most people are like, kids get to go to school here. It's an exciting place. Park City High School continues to push the curve and try to be a leader in education in Utah.
And this sort of goes along with your cooperation agreements with UVU for other kinds of, what's the right word for collaborative?
Yeah, so we have concurrent enrollment classes, AP classes, and then we're really excited about our relationship with MTech, which is where students get some of this trade skills, and there's a Heber campus opening up. So the opportunities keep expanding, and we believe in expanding opportunities for our students.
So Isaiah, Treasure Hill's going to close.
Yes.
What is that going to do to Eckerd? Talk to us about the challenges you foresee in sort of managing that different population.
Yeah, so I think our challenge staff-wise is we are trying to mend and weave two staffs, right? We've got an existing staff at Treasure Mountain with their traditions, their culture, and their abilities. And then we have one at Ecker Hill. And so we want to bring them together and really bring the good that they have and add to the good that's going on at Ecker Hill. And we're excited about what that means for like the seventh graders rising into the eighth grade team, which is just a powerhouse team. We're grateful to minimize the transitions, right? We're cutting down from three now down to two, and just trying to, enable and empower the positive things from both schools and elevate them so that everyone is aware of the great things and can kind of build and collaborate and go from there.
Can you remind our listeners mechanically what's going to happen here?
Yes. Yeah. So in the fall of this year, so the fall of 2025, Treasure Mountain is going to be closed as a school, and the ninth grade class, the freshman class, will be shifted over to Park City High as a traditional 9-12 high school. And our eighth grade class is going to shift to Ecker Hill as a traditional 6-8 middle school. And the staffs are being split. Primarily ninth grade will go to the high school. Primarily eighth grade will go to the middle school. And Principal Fine will be the principal of the high school, and myself will be at Ecker Hill.
And again, given the class enrollment size, I take it that these buildings are going to be adequate to handle that population?
Yeah, so last night was actually the ribbon cutting ceremony for Ecker Hill, and Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman spoke, President Reed of the school board, and Dr. Garrett Rose, current principal at Ecker Hill, had the chance to walk through the building, see the new spaces. Yes, they are expanded, they are new, they are impressive, and so yes, we are ready to go. The logistical work of realignment is over, just about, and the cultural work, the instructional work is about to begin.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about sort of the overall challenges of dealing with a changing world. What specifically, Caleb, what do you anticipate being your specific biggest challenges over the next year?
I think that the biggest challenges are going to continue to push the curve. When we have an incredibly successful school, it's easy to get set just and stagnant. And we want to continue to push and continue to grow and continue to evolve. We want to be the number one high school in Utah. We want to be the number one high school in the nation because we're pushing incredibly positive relationships and incredible academics, right? We're an institution of learning, and we've got to continue to push. And it is challenging to continue to move things forward when you've had so much success. But we believe that there's another level to go to, and realignment is a charge to get there.
And I assume you're going to resist the temptation to get directly involved with the basketball team.
I am going to watch a lot of basketball games, and I look forward to all the extracurricular from the theater program to the volleyball team. I love watching the extracurriculars. It's a special space in high school.
Isaiah, what are you seeing as your biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge at Ecker Hill is really melding these two staffs. There are not conflicts between these two staffs, but we have done some nascent work to kind of bridge cultures, bridge like instructional awareness of like, hey, what are you doing in eighth grade, and how what does that look like in seventh grade and sixth grade, and how do we blend them all together? So I think the challenge is really just, again, elevating teacher efficacy, letting everyone know what's going on, and kind of building some instructional coherence through all the grades.
And I think it's a tribute to the Park City school system that they were able to retain and attract people like you. It is a wonderful thing when a school district can grow its own. And we appreciate both of you being here. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. Always a pleasure.
We'll be right back after this. The Park City Council held its regular meeting last night. Here in the studio to talk about it is Council Member Ed Parisian. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Well, some people are going to ask, is it a good morning? Because the headline from yesterday is the decision that the circus is leaving town. The Sundance Film Festival has decided to no longer make its home here in Park City.
No.
What's your reaction?
I'm sad. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hit you till last night after the meeting, and I'm like, oh, it just hit me. I'm like, so many good movies that I've seen, and it's sad. I don't even know what to say.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you think that the city could or should have done anything different to try to keep the festival here?
I don't think we could have. I mean, we went all out. Sarah, our assistant city manager, Sarah Pierce, they did, you know. No, I don't think we could have. We wanted to keep them. They know it. We got beat up.
Was there any discussion last night about what the city might do to try to sort of fill the financial hole that the loss of that revenue is going to create?
I think it's a little quick to think about that. We're still mourning.
We're still in the first stage of grief.
Right, exactly. So we'll figure something out. But, yeah, I'm going to miss it a lot.
Okay. The Treasure Hill conservation easement was approved last night. What was the... there was an issue regarding the ability to approve changes. Can you explain how that was resolved?
Yeah. So, like I said, yesterday was one of those up-and-down days, right? Sadness of Sundance and the joy of getting the easement as we look at it up there in place. So, it was... They have a lot of rights already. Mm-hmm. From previous to the town lift agreement, there's a lot of rights built into that. So we just wanted to probably tie up any future rights. Not tie them up, but just put oversight over them. You know the story. The town rose up against that big development. We wanted to preserve it. We got it. We paid $64 million on it. We just want to make sure that it stays what we paid the money for. So, they can change a lift if they want. They can put snowmaking in. That's all. They have the right to...
That was an existing right, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. So,
last night, as I understand it, and the basic control of the potential changes to that region is now with Summit Land Conservancy. Is that basically right?
No.
Okay.
I wouldn't say control of it. I mean, they have conservation values, right?
Right.
So they can't say, oh, we don't like it. They have to make sure that it complies with what we want in that conservation easement. So just oversight,
Oversight, okay.
Yeah.
So the oversight is with...
We still own it.
Right. But the Summit Land Conservancy has the oversight of changes in use, basically.
Yeah, okay. To some extent, yes.
Okay,
it's complicated.
Yes. We'll be. I believe some of our reporters are going to be delving into more of that later today to try to go into some more depth. And what did the city approve last night with respect to the Song Summit?
We gave them the go-ahead pending some further work on mitigating the day camp down there. The kids' camp at the city park. Some maybe a little more work on the parking. And a little refinement of how they're going to get people in and out with maybe Ubers and Lyfts and stuff like that.
And let me see if I've got this straight. As I understand it, what was approved last night was that the Song Summit would have a much bigger footprint within Park City limits, where traditionally it was almost always out over in the canyons.
Right.
And that the issue you just mentioned was that if they are going to have operations that are down at City Park, it would disrupt that daycare. The day camp operations, and that's what has to be sort of worked on a little bit.
Right, and they're disrupting other things
as well,
not child-related. So that's turns out that Friday is their final day of camp. So they do a little celebration or not sure. But so we can figure it out.
Now, one of the things that Sundance traditionally did was Sundance did offer a local resident discounts on packages for years. They used to be substantial. They started becoming somewhat less substantial.
So much, right?
What about the Song Summit? Do they offer local discounts, and is that something you'd like to see them do more of?
Well, I brought that up last night and was told that they were going to give discounts to some of the neighbors that are impacted, and they didn't say how much.
Because those tickets are kind of have you looked at the prices?
Yeah,
they're a little pricey.
Last year was in the $80 range, wasn't it? At the annual rate lifting them. So I brought that up. I'm I'm a little something here, but I didn't get a positive answer.
I was going to say, what kind of response did you get?
I didn't get such a great answer. So okay.
Is that
we'll
still
see.
Open?
I'd like to see it open. They said they don't sell out Fridays usually. Is that so there's room, I think, to help the locals out.
Okay.
But they do. Ben did say they do some through the nonprofit arm. So.
To their foundation?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else I missed on last night's meeting?
What else did you miss? Let's see. We bought a new health policy.
Oh, and that's interesting because I know when the first draft budget came out, they were expecting a huge increase in the cost of that health insurance. You guys did a lot better, didn't you?
It's still over $7 million.
Right, but in terms of a percentage increase from last year, it was...
Yeah, that was
they were talking about,
30, and I think they got it down to 16%.
Which is pretty impressive. I mean, I give credit to the... I take it that the people in the city must have shopped it pretty aggressively to try to get that price down.
They did, and we're changing carriers. So
so everybody will deal with having to get new providers.
Is your doctor allowed?
But for that kind of price range, I can see why the city would have to do that.
And I think the city... I'm not on their health plan, but it's quality. We have quality. And we talked about water rates a little bit, not a final vote, trying to figure out tiers and all that. One thing we did on Wednesday that was kind of interesting was we did a city manager work plan. So it's kind of a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt, the city manager, is going to give us a quarterly update on where we stand on each project that we're working on. You look down the front, it's like, boy, we're working on a lot of stuff here. Mm-hmm. So just where we're at, what's next, a little blurb so we jog our memory so we can stay on those things. So I think that's going to be great, especially for someone like me that things go flying through my head. So I like to have a little
roadmap.
It definitely helps. So
now, Ed, last week you guys talked about ranked choice voting.
We did.
And you were the only council member who did not endorse it.
I'm right.
Why?
I don't think we need it. I've done a lot of reading on it since we brought it up last year, and it doesn't seem like it's going to do anything for us. So we're a nonpartisan race, and that seems to be one of the reasons that people like it. It allows the non-majority people to possibly get in, but we don't have that thing. I think another reason is I think you got to earn this thing. If you're going to have a shortened Election, maybe you're not going to get your word out. Maybe people are just going to check off your name. Oh, yeah, so-and-so, number 4, 5, 6, whatever. And I don't think that's how it should be. I think you need to earn it. I've gone through 2 campaigns. I know.
But it does eliminate the primary, which saves some money and makes for a shortened season. It might get some more attention.
You know, how much money?
Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's petty cash when you look at it.
I take it you'll be interested in how it works out this time.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Especially with the mayor not going to rerun. So, all kinds of news this week.
And speaking of which, I'm going to ask you, as I will be asking every council member who comes on the air. So, Ed, are you declaring your candidacy for mayor in 2026?
No.
Or 2021.
Okay. I am not.
Okay. Well, if you decide, please do it here first.
I will. I'll tell you. But, yeah, I like where I am at.
Okay. Anything else you want to cover before we go?
Are you sad that Sundance is leaving?
I am.
I'm going to miss.
Yeah,
I was thinking last night all the great movies that I've seen. And, boy, it just...
Well, we'll have one last year, and hopefully it'll be a good one. So, Ed Parisian, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
All right, Raj. We'll see you in a couple months? About
6 weeks. We'll be right back after this. Joining me in the studio now is Sydney Weaver, KPCW News producer, Mitch Elliott, KPCW Assistant Program Director, and Connor Thomas, KPCW's Summit County Reporter. Now, why have I gathered all these employees in the studio? It's because they spent last Saturday in a very interesting way. Sydney Weaver, what'd you guys do?
We skied all 34 Park City chairlifts from Town Lift all the way to Super Condor. It is something that I did with my ski team when I was growing up, Summit Ski Team, which is not around anymore. But we skied all of Canyons, and we tried to ski all of Park City when they joined, but it never happened. So now I finally got to do it.
And whose idea was it? Was it your idea to come up with it?
Yeah.
Okay, and what did you guys call it?
We argued about the name. I always called it Race Around the Mountain.
Yeah, this is Connor. I'd heard it called the whole enchilada / enchilada race, so it had a very long name with the big colon on it.
Yep. Okay, Mitch, how long did it take?
It took all day. We started the day over at Town Lift, and we got up on the hill starting around like 8:45. They start Town Lift a little earlier, so that saved us some time. And the race that we had finished around 3:36, I think, was the final time there. So all day.
Okay, so you start at the Town Lift. Give us sort of an overview of, you know, how long were you over in the Park City side, and when do you sort of take the gondola over to the Canyon side? Connor.
Yeah, we didn't tell each other how we mapped it out before we did this. It was a competition. Once we both realized we wanted to take the slowest lift on the mountain up first, we rode the Town Lift up together. We ended up going up Bonanza together, and then we realized we went to McConkie's together. And then to Pioneer, and I think I showed up to Jupiter after y'all, like, 5 chairs back and never saw you ever again until about 11 p.m., I think, or 11:30 is when we made it over to Quicksilver. I showed up 15 seconds before them, and we ended up having roughly the same route on both sides of the mountain, just with a couple chairs transposed here and there.
Okay, so any idea how many vertical feet you guys skied?
I have the stats pulled up because it's very important. Connor and I both tracked it. I think he tracked it through Strava, and I tracked it through Garmin. And mine said we skied about 34,000 vertical. Connor, you had 36?
No, confirmed, 34,029 feet.
So that is how many, if you ski each lift, that's how it is, 34.
Okay, and were there any lifts closed or anything you had to skip for any sort of mechanical or practical reason?
No, we were able to hit all of the lifts that we expected to. We thought Shortcut might have been closed off, but that ended up being open, so that was an interesting crux in the journey, and it was Sydney and I on one team and Connor on the other, so he had the advantage of going through a lot of singles lines and stuff, so he was able to make up some time there. But Sydney was a former ski racer, and I grew up here skiing, so we also had speed to our side. So it was an interesting, little race between us.
And do we have any record of what the top speeds that anyone skied?
Yeah, unfortunately, I was a little slower. I was 48 miles an hour top speed.
I think Mitchell and I hit about 51, 52 miles an hour at one point.
What run was that? Do you remember?
Oh, man, it was probably when we were trying to get ahead of Connor. Connor, when we were on the Canyon side, got ahead of us on a couple of lifts because he was able to go through the singles line, and we got cut off by ski school.
And did you guys, did either of you have a better strategic plan, given that he had to use singles lines? Was your plan better, Sydney?
Our plans were pretty similar. The only thing that really differed was when we took mother load and silver load, and we were trying to factor in lift lines, but this Saturday there were no lift, there were very few lift lines.
No, yeah, we timed it to do payday later in the day and stuff like that, so you didn't have morning lines, but across the mountain there was no crowd last Saturday.
Okay. Have you guys picked out another resort to do a similar kind of adventure yet?
We'd love to do it over at Deer Valley as well to get the full Park City experience. That will be another interesting challenge with the new expanded terrain over there as well.
I think doing it next year would be a lot of fun. Okay.
Not advocating this, but there's the Forbidden Enchilada where you drop the Empire Pass rope.
That's not allowed. You will get your pass pulled.
You will. Right. You will.
All right. Sydney Weaver, Mitch Elliott, and Connor Thomas, thanks for spending time with me this morning.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Roger.
Well, it is indeed the morning after. The morning after Sundance announced that it was leaving town. I'm joined in the studio by Jennifer Wesselhoff, the president and CEO of Visit Park City, or the Park City Chamber of Commerce. Park City Chamber of Commerce is a KPCW financial supporter. She's here to talk about the big Sundance announcement. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you feeling today?
Good morning, Roger. I'm definitely feeling all of the feelings. There's sadness, there's anger, there's hurt, there's disappointment. It's a sad day.
We're climbing through Maslow's various stages of grief rather rapidly, it sounds like.
I think you're right. Yeah, it does. It does feel a little bit like a grieving process, or potentially like a divorce. I'm in a very happy, healthy marriage, but I can imagine if you're going through a divorce, this is probably what it feels like.
Well, let's talk about the decision. Were you surprised by the decision?
You know, I can't say that any of us were too surprised, because it's been a year-long process. And, you know, obviously the Sundance Institute had been thinking about other communities because they began this RFP process about a year or so ago. So there was always a chance that we weren't going to be the winners, but we feel that we put together a very strong proposal that we felt addressed the needs and the concerns that Sundance Institute had shared with us.
Was there anything different that you think the city or the state could have or should have done?
No.
Okay.
No, I feel so good. That last meeting that we had 2 weeks ago with the selection committee, after we left that meeting, we felt so good that whatever we did everything that we could.
You ran through the tape.
We did. Mm-hmm. We did everything that we could. We had such a good financial package presented to them. We talked about their affordability and accessibility, and we addressed that through the Main Street to Main Street program. And we can go into a little bit more detail of the bid if you would like to, and what we presented, but we felt really confident that we did everything that we possibly could to keep them here.
I want to talk about some of the details of the bid, but you know, there have been indications that politics did not play a role. Do you think things like Senator McKay's rather overt hostile statement could have affected the decision?
You know, the governor and Sundance shared with us that politics would not play a role. But, you know, Sundance actually shared the story about the flag bill when we talked about it at our meeting a couple of weeks ago. And that flag bill and the rhetoric around that was not helpful, especially in the week before the board met to plan. And, you know, that was something that we talked a lot about in the bid process. With the committee and the selection committee, talking about how Sundance's brand not only interlinks so tightly with Park City, but also as being a disruptor. Mm-hmm. And bringing new and diverse ideas and concepts to Utah has truly shaped Utah. And we feel and still feel that they made such a difference on our social and cultural values within our state. And we pushed them on that. We challenged them to continue to think that way, because sharing those ideas in Boulder and in Colorado is maybe more of an echo chamber and maybe less impactful than it is and has been over the last 40 years in Park City and in Utah.
One of the things that obviously affects decisions like this are the financial incentives. Can you share a little bit about our package and then what we know about the Colorado package so people can understand how that might have affected the decision making?
I don't know a lot about the Colorado package. Obviously, we're not privy to that as their competitors,
the
right? But what we saw in the press was a $34 million guaranteed 10-year package. And, you know, while our bid included significant in-kind value, it included about $6 million of in-kind value in Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, Park City, Summit County. And then our annual cash contribution with all of the players, and that's all of the partners that I just mentioned, in addition to private donors that stepped up to the table and agreed to donate on a 10-year, on a signature contract. It was quite significant. It was over $5 million in annual cash. It was over the course of 10-year cash contributions, over $50 million. But where I think it was different is our makeup of our financial package was a lot of different pieces, and Sundance would have to apply for those through a grant process like the Summit County Restaurant Tax or the ZAP grants or, you know, the different grants, whereas I believe that the Colorado package was a more guaranteed fund.
Yeah. Let's talk about the annual economic impact of the festival on the city and the surrounding area. I'm sure you probably have some figures at your fingertips. Is this a big deal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to underestimate or sugarcoat the economic impact to our community. Sundance has a $130 million economic impact to the state. How that breaks down to our county and our city is a little bit more complex to gather that information. It's definitely in the tens of millions of dollars in direct visitor spending. So that impacts our traditional tourism-related businesses, which you would normally think about, our hotels, our restaurants, our galleries, our shops, our transportation companies, our event planners, you know, the traditional tourism-related businesses. But people forget that it also trickles through to our stylists and our makeup artists and, you know, really trickles through our economy to our homeowners who are maybe renting their homes where they maybe traditionally don't rent their homes out, but they may rent them out during Sundance. And then, you know, it's, we think about the tax collections that then trickle through to our residents in terms of investment at our city and county level for resident quality of life and our resident amenities. So it's a big economic hit. It's in the tens of millions of dollars. And we're disappointed about that.
You know, I've heard some people yesterday, obviously this was a big topic of conversation yesterday, saying, a few Main Street storefront owners lose an annual windfall, but, you know, it doesn't really affect the rest of us that much. And the answer is, yeah, it does.
Yeah, and I think it's just not the economic impact. Yeah. It's the social and cultural and brand identity that we have had. And in addition to all of that, you know, I had the opportunity to sit in and listen to the incident command post. You know, it's things like that that happen behind the scenes where our transportation companies and our sheriff and our police and our security systems, they all get the opportunity to work together and practice to put on safe and secure events like this. And it really has been part of what has made Park City such a sophisticated community that can attract world-class events like this.
You know, the brand identity thing is so real. I mean, the idea, the sort of integration of Sundance on the one hand and Park City on the other is so strong. I mean, we could probably come up with a half a dozen examples in popular culture of, you know, the guys at Entourage. We're going to Park City for Sundance. I mean, all these sort of, that's a big sort of almost rubber band snap mm-hmm. as you see this coming apart. And Jennifer, your job, I think, is brand management among your jobs. It's really important, the Park City brand. We have this, we have the skiers strike in December. This feels like a bit of a double whammy. Got some work to do.
Yeah, I think we have some work to do. And I wouldn't say it was, this has been ongoing since COVID, right? I mean, Sundance had to reinvent themselves during COVID with the 2021 event that was canceled, the 2022 event that was remote. So we have recent experience of what Park City is like without a Sundance.
That's a really good point.
And we did okay, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we came through that. We're adaptable. We're resilient. But yeah, these are things that we need to think about. You know, when we talk about sustainable tourism and what that looks like for our community, a lot of that is around brand identity. It's around sustainable economy, but it also, one of those objectives is around elevating arts and culture in our community and thinking about now, how can we adapt, how can we evaluate and reimagine and reinvest into the local arts, our local artists, and really redefine what arts look like in Park City and Summit County.
And you make a really good point, which is one thing that Sundance did for us is it put us on the map as a cultural destination. We have, obviously, the Summer Arts Fest. There are other things. Are you guys going to be looking at potentially trying to figure out some other kinds of arts and culture-related festivals or attractions to try to bring to the town?
Absolutely. And I think first and foremost, we need to focus on what's already here. We have really great events here that want to grow and are supporting our local artists and our local people. And we want to continue to invest in them because, you know, they're our beating heart of our community. You know, we have so much to offer in terms of being winter's favorite town and our ski season, our ski industry. We have so much to offer, and leading up to the games, we're absolutely going to lean into that. We're going to have several large events, world championships, world cups, opportunities to really lean into that winter outdoor recreation. There's going to be a lot of opportunity to lean into summer outdoor recreation events. And what we really need to think about now is how can we prioritize the arts? And what does that look like with events like the Song Summit or the wine, you know, the wine festival that is actually starting a spring festival as well? So I think there's a lot of opportunity. And I guess I just want the community and the listeners to know that while we lost this one, and it never feels good to lose, right? We have one more year with Sundance in 2026. We have a long runway to really celebrate all of the great things that are happening in Park City and elevate those. And while it is a loss, I think there's an opportunity to reimagine what arts in Park City looks like.
And you mentioned something else, which is January is prime ski month. I mean, to what extent are we likely to see a significant portion of, obviously, when Sundance is in town, all those rooms are booked and mostly to people who don't ski.
Right.
And indeed, for those of us who are long-term skiers, it's indeed one of the best weeks of the year to ski because it's January and the slopes are empty. Do you think that we'll be able to, there'll be a marketing effort to fill that week with skiers or ski events that will be largely successful?
Absolutely. That's our job. I mean, we spend a lot of money to attract the right type of visitor when we need them, particularly in those 157 days of ski season where businesses tell us that, you know, they make 60 to 70% of all of their revenue during ski season. And that's an incredibly important part of what we do. You know, and I think this example of Sundance really just shows and reminds us that, you know, tourism is fragile and it is competitive. And we need to remember that there's a lot of other destinations out there fighting for those same tourism dollars and those same 157 days that we are. And we need to continue to be out there and be competitive in the marketplace.
I do want to ask, obviously, the December, there was a lot of unfortunate national publicity on the ski patroller strike. Has that been reflected in a decline in stays in March, for example? Because my sense is that it hasn't.
We haven't seen that, yeah. Roger. We haven't seen any quantifiable impact to our sales tax collections, our visitor days, our occupancy, our average daily rates. None of that has been impacted by that. I do think that people generally have a short memory span, and Park City has so much to offer, and we are a city that focuses on hospitality, and we do that really well, and we will continue to do that across every level of our tourism industry.
Okay, anything else you want to touch on before we go, as we go through this long day after?
Just one thing. I think, you know, as we think about arts and events in our community, I would encourage our leaders and our residents to support the events that are important to them. Volunteer, donate, attend, vocally support those events, because it's events like that in our community that keep us alive, they keep us vibrant, they keep us dynamic, and it's a lot of the reasons why we live here. So let's support them.
Well, I'm going to give you the opportunity to remind our listeners of what's coming up this spring and summer. What are some of the big events that they should be thinking about?
Well, we have the PC Wine Festival coming up.
What is that?
That's the, you know, we usually have the wine festival that happens in the fall. We have a new event that's happening in a couple of weeks at Canyons Village, celebrating another wine festival. So trying to do both a fall and a spring event to really end the season strong. And our events calendar is really the best place to see what's going on in Park City, and that's visitparkcity.com.
Arts Fest will be in August?
Arts Fest, Savor the Summit.
Savor the Summit is in June?
Yeah.
All I know is that it may be in June, but every year I always don't wear enough coats. It's always cold, but it's really, really a lot of fun. All right, Jennifer Wesselhoff, thanks for spending time with us on this tough day. We'll be right back after this. You've been listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Coming up Monday on Mountain Money, we've got a really interesting interview with a guy named Mark Dunkelman. His book is called Why Nothing Works Anymore. And what it talks about is the way that governmental bureaucracies have sort of evolved in such a way that it's really difficult to do the big things in life. Talks a lot about Robert Moses, and for all of his controversies, he did get a lot done in New York, both good and bad. Should be an interesting talk. Please join us.